Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
So I spend a lot of time looking at houses on Zillow. And lately, I noticed that even in places where houses are usually expensive, they seem even more expensive. Like here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
What has the last year been like?
It's shocking. Buyers are paying 15 to 20% above asking price now. I had a listing in South San Francisco, 32 offers, 31 very unhappy buyers.
For years, the Bay Area has been an extreme example of how difficult it is to find affordable housing in the U.S. It's where Silicon Valley bus drivers sleep in their cars at night because they can't afford housing near work, and where school teachers can't afford to live in the counties they teach. But it's not just the Bay Area. The lack of affordable housing is a national problem, and right now, it's worse than ever.
We've seen over the last year housing prices reach a level they've never reached before in American history. They kind of just look like a rocket ship, you know, going to the moon. Housing prices reaching a median of $350,000 for the median American home.
Those prices have made rents more expensive and have made homeownership less attainable for millions of Americans. So why is this happening? And how do we bring that rocket ship closer to Earth? We can think of today's housing prices in terms of a supply and demand problem. On the demand side, there are a few things happening. The first is a generational shift in who's buying homes.
Millennials are the biggest generation in American history, and they're aging into their prime home buying years.
On top of that, mortgage rates are at an all-time low, which means it's very cheap to borrow the money needed to buy a house. That's enticed more people to buy if they can, making demand for houses even higher. The problem is that supply isn't matching that demand. From 2010 to 2019, there were fewer homes built in the U.S. than in any decade since the 1960s. In particular, the construction of smaller, entry-level housing, the kind made for first-time homebuyers, has dropped dramatically. In the 1980s, those starter homes made up around 40% of all homes built. Today, it's closer to 7%. In 2018, one estimate said the U.S. housing market was 2.5 million homes short of meeting demand. By the end of 2020, it was 3.8 million.
And that's driving a big part of the problem, both for renters and for people who want to be homeowners.
The shortage is worst in the places where demand is highest, near good jobs, transit, and schools. And one pretty straightforward solution to that is to just build more homes in those places. But for years, there's been one big obstacle to that. We aren't allowed to. Take a look at this map of the Bay Area. It's showing something called zoning, or local regulations that decide what can be built where. This much of the region is zoned for residential housing. In blue are areas zoned to allow multifamily housing, while the areas shaded in pink are zoned for single-family housing only. That's 82% of all residential land in the Bay Area.
What it means is that you've banned the ability for anyone to build anything other than a single unit of housing on that lot of land.
And in many towns, like Atherton, they've excluded all multifamily housing from their neighborhoods.
And that doesn't just mean a giant apartment building. It means things like duplexes, things like, fourplexes, things like that are illegal in the majority of the country.
This is an example of something called exclusionary zoning. It's a big part of the reason for the housing supply shortage in the U.S. And single-family only zoning is just one way local laws limit how much housing we can build. Many places also employ height restrictions. In Cupertino, California, some areas are zoned for multifamily buildings, but they don't allow any buildings over two stories. Parking requirements are often written into zoning laws too. Cupertino requires developers to set aside space for two parking spaces for each unit of multifamily housing. That means if you were building an apartment complex that had 100 units, you'd need to find space for 200 parking spots, which usually means buildings that size don't get built at all.
They lower the number of units they're actually building so they can save space for those parking spaces. And then those units become more expensive because the land still stays the same cost to the developer. And you then get a situation where potentially more affordable units turn into higher income servicing units.
Another feature of many zoning laws is minimum lot sizes. It means builders are legally required to allot a minimum amount of land for each home, often a large amount of land. In Cupertino, most single-family lots must be at least 5,000 square feet each.
Starter homes are usually around 1,400 to 1,500 square feet, and so you've basically banned all that type of housing.
In Atherton, the minimum lot size for homes is 1 acre, more than 43,000 square feet, which makes it virtually impossible to build any kind of affordable home there. Together, exclusionary zoning laws like this push builders across the country to focus on bigger, luxury homes instead of smaller starter homes or multifamily housing,
essentially creating gated communities in public spaces. What you are saying is that you are only allowing people who have already been able to partake in the wealth of this country and to grow their income and have access to high opportunity jobs and education to live in our neighborhoods.
Historically, some of the first zoning laws in the U.S. were engineered for that exactly, to block people of color, and in particular Black Americans, from living in predominantly white neighborhoods. Today, the laws don't explicitly mention race, but they continue to worsen segregation. In the Bay Area, the more single-family zoning in a neighborhood, the whiter it is. But all this has another effect as well. By shrinking the pot of new housing getting built, while demand keeps rising, it drives up the cost of housing for everyone. Changing zoning laws can be difficult, and often the biggest obstacles are the wealthiest residents.
A process is usually defined by who shows up to these public meetings. And what you have is often a much whiter, wealthier crowd, the ones who come and say, I don't want this in my community. I'm concerned about what will happen to my property values. And then there's this kind of code word, neighborhood character.
Remember those teachers I mentioned who can't afford to live in the counties where they teach? Well, in 2018, one local school district proposed a solution, building affordable housing units for teachers in San Jose. It caused an uproar among San Jose parents who petitioned against changing the neighborhood. It may not seem like a big deal when one wealthy neighborhood blocks one multifamily development. The problem is that it happens all the time. Communities block new housing everywhere.
People are, when they hear this kind of rhetoric, very confused because they're like, you know, why I don't want to live in a place with 10,000 apartment buildings. It doesn't even make sense to do that. And they're right. No one is saying that there should be every neighborhood in every city should be, 10,000-foot apartment buildings or anything like that.
But even small, gradual changes to zoning laws can have an impact. For example, allowing smaller homes on smaller lots or simply allowing duplexes would double capacity for housing in some areas. In recent years, some cities like Berkeley, Minneapolis, and Portland have taken the huge step of ending single-family zoning. But the problem is nationwide.
The real fix is going to happen when these decisions start being made and start being regulated at the statewide level or at the federal level in some capacity.
Today, the Biden administration is attempting to tackle exclusionary zoning through a $5 billion program that would give money to localities that remove exclusionary zoning policies. But even that may not be enough.
This is more than any presidential administration has done on this topic, either Democrat or Republican. It is also very small in the face of this problem. They want to take action, they recognize how big of a deal it is, but they are not actually willing to create the kind of political blowback from often very high-value voters living in suburban environments.
Ending America's housing shortage will require real political willpower, and it'll require people across the country to take a look at their own neighborhoods. What gets built, who gets excluded, and how to make homeownership achievable for the millions who are shut out.
Okay, today's podcast, we did a live stream yesterday. There's an echo right here. Okay. We went on at 3 o'clock yesterday. We were on for 2 hours yesterday, but we started at 3. pandemic scheduling. In any event, today's podcast is titled Affordable Housing Made Illegal Via Exclusionary Housing. Now, affordable, what's affordable? It's a very subjective term. I'm going to put affordable at $50,000 and below. The It's My House definition of affordable is a house that's priced at no more than $50,000 or below. Now, that, you know what? All right, that's definition. I'm going to call that definition B. Definition A is affordable is any house that you can pay for in cash and not borrow any money. That's the It's My House primary definition of affordable. The secondary definition of affordable is the house is priced at no more than $50,000. Now, let's go back to definition A. When you walk into McDonald's, is priced. Fast foods in general are priced where you can go in there, pay your dollar, $5, and walk out with the product. You can go to Home Depot, Menards, Lowe's. You can walk into those hardware, big box hardware stores. And of all socioeconomic levels, you can be on Section 8. You can be live below the park. And you can go in there and buy a hammer. You can buy a number of items in that store, cash and carry, because their price, retail pricing, is affordable pricing. But if you've got to, if you have to borrow money, in my opinion, that's a sure sign of sustainability. I mean, excuse me, non-sustainability. Particularly if you got to pay it back in 30 years, you know, that's nonsense. So I'm looking at affordable as something that you can pay for without borrowing money. The Amish and many Mennonites, they build their houses and there's no debt. All right. A lot of the early presidents of the United States, they built their houses with no debt. But a lot of us now are, if you can't afford it, then all right, take out a loan. That's for a car, whatever. So, exclusionary zoning. All right, if we can't get them, if they can borrow money, well, there might be some exclusionary zoning where we can get them out that way. Now, we've done on here a few times the documentary Flag Wars. As a matter of fact, we need to bring one of the people that was in that documentary back on, and he's been on here twice before. And there's a whole bunch of things that pop up with that. But in any event, let's go on to the next audio. And once again, today's topic is housing, affordable housing made illegal. Like, I'll give you an example before I play this next one. In Washington, D.C. Now, Washington, D.C., which has no rural areas at all. Okay. Although they have Rock Creek Park, but that's a recreational type thing. There are a shrinking number of people in Washington, D.C. that happen to be black that really could use some affordable housing, and older people too. But Washington, D.C.'s affordable housing is shrinking. Now, tiny houses, the reason why tiny houses have become so popular on a global level is because they're affordable. They're affordable to get into. They're affordable to maintain. And let me give my definition of tiny houses. Something that's no more than 399 square feet, 399 square feet and below in square footage, and costing no more than $25,000. Most people who purchase tiny homes build them. They build them. They don't have any debt. And most of them are not spending $25,000. Some do, but most don't. All right? But tiny houses are sustainable. They're affordable. However, like in a place like Washington, D.C., at this time, at least, tiny houses. Now, you can have one up. There's a place in D.C. where they have a tiny house exhibit. Legally, those houses are not allowed to live in. And, like I said, there's a shrinking number of people in Washington, D.C. Baby boomers, as well as a mixture of other people that really could use it, but they can't afford it. So the exclusionary zoning boots them out of the neighborhood or out of the city. In any event, let's go to the next audio.
Hey, team. My name is Shelley, and your city is probably racist. Today, we're talking about exclusionary zoning. First, let's define what zoning is. Very basically put, zoning is a tool the government uses to determine what kinds of land uses can go where. It's what says that you can't build a coal plant next to an elementary school. If you've ever played SimCity, you know that there are three very basic types of zoning: industrial, commercial, residential. Exclusionary zoning is when this zoning tool gets used to keep certain socioeconomic classes out of residential neighborhoods. Let's dig into how that works. Around the turn of the 20th century, two big things were happening. First, a massive wave of urbanization. That means more people were living in cities than were living outside of cities. Second, there was a ton of immigration, and thus the xenophobic resistance to immigration that comes along with it. On top of all of that, our country was in the middle of Jim Crow laws and all of the painfully explicit anti-black bias that came with those. With this dramatic increase in urbanization, policymakers decided it was time to make cities a little bit more organized, so they created zoning districts to determine what kinds of land uses could go where. This was the birth of zoning. And because this was Jim Crow America, using zoning to keep white residents segregated from black and immigrant residents seemed like a pretty obvious action. The mayor of Baltimore in 1910 said that black Baltimoreans, quote, should be quarantined in isolated slums in order to reduce the incidence of civil disturbance, to prevent the spread of communicable disease into nearby white neighborhoods, and to protect property values among the white majority. Yikes. So cities started using zoning not only to separate land uses, but to separate white residents from black residents. It wasn't until 1917 that this kind of explicit exclusionary zoning was deemed unconstitutional. But just like I mentioned in the last video, just because something is made illegal doesn't stop people from doing it. Over time, exclusionary zoning changed from explicit whites-only language to more subtle language, largely taking advantage of the fact that black residents historically have been less likely to afford homes in single-family zoning districts than their white counterparts. In 1977, there was a Supreme Court case that challenged this more subtle type of exclusionary zoning. A nonprofit housing developer sued their city because, they argued, their city's building code was racially discriminatory. The developer wanted to build multifamily homes, so things like apartments, duplexes, townhouses, etc., in an area that was zoned for single-family homes, and the city said no. The developer argued in court that the building code, even though it didn't say anything about race, its impact was ultimately effective of racial discrimination because black residents were less likely in that city to be able to afford single-family homes than white residents were. The Supreme Court sided with the city. And this is what exclusionary zoning looks like today. There are all kinds of zoning regulations that can push home costs up, ultimately driving low-income home seekers out of the housing market. Think about requirements for things like lot sizes, density maximums, setbacks. Ultimately, exclusionary zoning has the effect of reproducing racism in American cities by strengthening the likelihood that a white resident can live in a neighborhood that a black resident can't afford to live in. This has all kinds of implications for things like access to good schools, economic opportunity, and even things like high-quality food. And this is an example of how cyclical segregation is. Your zip code is a profoundly strong indicator of your educational attainment and earning capacity. And if you're never able to earn enough money to move to a new neighborhood, you're stuck. My name is Shelley, and your city is probably racist.
This video is sponsored by CuriosityStream. When you sign up at the link in the description, you also get access to Nebula, a streaming video service that City Beautiful is a part of.
The detached single-family home. It's the American dream. Neighborhoods filled with these homes are considered a great place to live and raise kids. Because the single-family home is so important to our culture, to our psyche, we've zoned a huge amount of our cities exclusively for single-family homes. No retail, no employment allowed. Most of our cities are a sort of zoning monoculture. In this video, I'm going to make the case that the single-family zone, known in most zoning maps as R1, needs to be eliminated. Before I make a case against single-family zoning, I want to make sure we're all on the same page with what zoning is, actually. Zoning is when a city is divided up into districts, or zones, and the zoning code says what type of uses are allowed in those zones, as well as how the buildings can look and function. If you're familiar with the game SimCity or City Skylines, you already get this. Industrial, commercial, and residential zones of varying intensities, from low density to high density, are common in real life, too. Let's look at a real zoning map. Here's a generalized zoning map for the city of Seattle. Their actual zoning code is much more complex with many more zones, but they provide a nice general look at their zoning here. You see a lot of yellow on this map. Yellow is the standard color for residential, and light yellow like this is standard for single-family residential. In the city of Seattle, 80% of the land area is zoned single-family residential. In many zoning codes, this is called R1 zoning, for residential at the lowest density, 1. I'm going to be calling it R1 in this video,
so I don't have to keep saying single-family zoning over and over. 80% may seem like a high number, but it's pretty common for U.S. cities to zone the vast majority of their land as R1. That means most of the land area is covered with single-family homes. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not attacking single-family homes, but I am making a case against zoning most of your city so that all you can build are single-family homes. That's terrible for the environment, terrible for segregation, and... Hold on. What's that clicking? Oh, hey, sorry. I was just trying to leave an angry comment on this video. Stop trying to take away houses that everyone wants, Dave. Eagleton, Dave. Well, you don't have to leave a comment. You're in this video with me. We can just discuss it together. Okay, that sounds good. I can tell you all the reasons that you're wrong, and you can fail to convince me that you're right. Sure, we can have a debate. It's actually a pretty useful way to discuss this topic. It's almost like I wrote you into the script. What's that now? Nothing. So why am I so wrong in thinking that single-family zoning has to go? Okay, I'll lead with the obvious one. People like to live in single-family homes. That's why we've zoned so much land for them. You can't change preferences. First of all, yes, many people love living in a single-family home, but tastes and preferences change. Many young people, for example, view a big house and a yard as more of a burden than an asset. One of the problems with R1 zoning is that it's been around for so long and employed so widely that it's constrained our choice and our imaginations. All we know is R1, and in many places it's the only housing choice available. It's like going to a store that only sells Cheerios and buying Cheerios. Can you really call that your preference? Maybe if you're a diehard Cheerios person, but with only one option, it's hard to call it everyone's preference. Furthermore, eliminating R1 zoning is not about changing people's preferences. It's about dropping the requirement that only single-family houses can be built in a large part of most U.S. cities. Why not let lots of different types of housing get built and see what people's tastes and preferences are once they're given a choice? What? So you want to let developers build high-rise housing next to single-family homes? Are you crazy? What about the shadows and the street parking? Those two things do not belong next to each other. Okay, allowing for housing at different densities does not mean developers are automatically going to build high-rise housing. High-rise housing is often built because of the amount of land zoned for multifamily housing is so constrained. Developers build up to maximize that scarce resource. If you look at places that don't have R1 zoning everywhere, say cities in Europe, you don't see forests of residential skyscrapers. You see pleasant-looking mid-rise buildings and townhomes. It's gentle density that's so nice-looking, Americans pay good money to take a vacation and walk around in it. R1 zoning creates this house, high-rise dichotomy and leaves out what planners call missing middle housing, like row houses. In the few places where housing like this has been built, it's been very popular. The demand is there, but R1 constrains their supply. Sure, those neighborhoods are nice to visit, but who would want to live there? You can't raise kids without nice big backyards. Plenty of families in the United States and all around the world raise children in dense cities. There are 1.1 million students in New York City public schools, many of whom live in townhouses, condos, and apartments. And it's silly to think that city kids turn out any worse than suburban kids. New York public school kids have gone on to win Nobel Prizes, Fields Medals, Oscars, Grammys, Olympic medals, and elections. A yard is not necessary for raising children. And again, I'm not saying we need to do away with the yard, or well, at least that's not what I'm saying in this video. I'm just saying we shouldn't be mandating yards for 80% of a city's land area.
Yeah, you bring up New York, but New York is always an outlier. Actually,
I'm going to turn the tables on you for a second. I'm going to make a case against single-family zoning, and you can tell me why you think it should stay.
Well...
Okay, great. One of the big problems with single-family zoning is inequality. Now, you may think that R1 zoning only came about because people demanded it or they thought it was a good place to raise kids. But R1 zoning turned out to be a pretty useful way for upper-income whites to exclude poor and minority households. Institutionalized racial segregation in residential areas was struck down by the Supreme Court in Buchanan v. Warley in 1917. But zoning, which was gaining in popularity at the same time, allowed for segregation by income. Wealthy, typically white families could afford these single-family homes, and the segregation effect was largely the same. R1 zoning basically makes households buy land in huge chunks, often a quarter acre or more at a time. Only middle and upper income families can buy land in that quantity, and this creates affluent neighborhoods. Imagine if you wanted to buy a car, but the only way you could is by buying them three at a time. Only wealthy families would drive. Opportunity and amenities are unevenly distributed in cities and metro areas. Wealthier neighborhoods are generally safer and have better schools. Building multifamily housing would help these residents access those opportunities and improve their quality of life.
But aren't the suburbs more diverse than ever? The idea that the suburbs, you know, where most of the R1 zoning is being all white and affluent is an outdated concept.
Wow, yeah, that's true, Eagles and Dave. I'm actually proud of you. That's some top quality planning knowledge you just dropped.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's the thing. Single-family homes in the suburbs are primarily owner-occupied. And yes, minority households are buying homes in the suburbs at increased rates, but white households are still overrepresented. And neighborhoods within suburbs are still segregated by income and race. Now that we've covered inequality, let's move on to the environment. R1 zoning requires houses to be separated from other houses on lots. R1 zoning often mandates large setbacks and lot sizes, which means homes are spaced far apart. This reduces overall density and increases the length everyone has to travel to get anywhere. We still rely primarily on internal combustion engine cars to get around, and longer trips mean more emissions. Larger lots also mean that new R1 areas require more space than denser housing types like duplexes and row houses. This means neighborhoods take up more land and potentially transform more natural areas and animal habitats into lawns and driveways. So what will happen if we get rid of single-family zoning in cities? Probably not a lot right away, but we'll likely see a greater variety of housing types as developers respond to a less regulated market. We may see more townhouses, which is a great housing type that's compact, good-looking, and often even has a small yard for the kids out back. Fun fact, 35% of households with kids in Philadelphia live in row houses. You may see more accessory dwelling units or small granny flats in backyards. You may see large houses that are just too big get separated into duplexes and fourplexes, just like many of the large old houses a few generations ago. All of these outcomes increase housing choice and housing supply and will likely increase housing affordability while not making a big difference in the overall character of many R1 neighborhoods.
Well, it doesn't matter if it sounds good or not. R1 zoning is sacred. Nobody's just going to let it go away.
There are places in the United States moving towards eliminating single-family zoning.
What? Where?
Minneapolis adopted a land use plan that sets 3 units as a residential minimum. No more single-family home mandate. California recently passed a law that allows homeowners to easily build up to 2 accessory dwelling units on their properties, effectively ending single-family zoning in the entire state. This doesn't mean there are no more R1 zones on our maps, though. Cities still have not upzoned or unzoned their R1 in any sort of meaningful way. But as planners and communities begin to realize the costs of single-family zoning, the tide may yet turn.
That's it? That's how you're going to end the video?
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good wrap-up. It ends on a hopeful note.
You're not even going to mention the streaming service you're part of? The one with Kritzkazat, CGB?
Good day, everybody. This is Krista. Call Krista. And today's tip happens to be about land and zoning. So the reason this came up is because I have several people that I've been speaking to that have been talking about having a granny unit or an ADU on their property. And in the process of that, we started talking about the zoning of the property. So most houses are on what's called an R1 lot. That means it's a residential single-family residence that's available for people to actually build their home on. There are also an R2 for 2 houses on one lot, R3 for 3 living dwellings on one lot, and R4 for 4 living dwellings on one lot. So the common ones are R1, and that's where most people are in a position where they live in one unit. Now, with the new granny unit requirements and the new ADU requirements, that has actually modified. So I have a client right now who has a perfect parcel. I just went down to the city, and they have an alley access, so they have the ability to put an ADU on the property. That increases both the value of the property, but also the options should the new buyer want to do something like that. So that's a very important marketing tip. And because of the fact that it has different setback requirements for an ADU, this particular parcel meets all of those. So that's sort of a tip of the day. Don't let the zoning be the only dictator. Do a little bit of research. Let me do the research. I know exactly what to ask for. I know how to approach it, and I know how to make certain that your property is marketed in a way to where you know what the most opportune options are available to you. And if you're looking at properties and you want to know what the options are for the property, we can discuss that as well. So that's your tip of the day. Zoning, R1, R2, R3, R4. And can you do an ADU? This is Call Krista, OIC Real Estate Services, helping you see your dreams come true. If you found this helpful, subscribe, ring the bell, forward it on to your family and friends. We love being a resource. And have a great day. Bye.
My home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salit are refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salits out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salits are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this. And paid it off, and we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired, and now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salit's home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salit's neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums with great views over the Rocky River. Those condos will be a cinch to sell. But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salits and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area and how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It is... really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term
meaning
that is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have three bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie,
the
breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all 7 council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have 2 bathrooms?
No.
Blight. 2-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or, I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute? Maybe. But without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
the city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of 3 restaurants and 4 businesses that once stood on this 5-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out 8 people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out, but he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
A thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away, and from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break-in front-end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Linhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this, and he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Linhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times. It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Okay, back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead. But the Salits, plus a dozen others, are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
And today's podcast is titled Affordable Housing Made Illegal Via Exclusionary Zoning. And that 60 Minutes piece was done back in the, it first aired in the, actually the late 70s. I remember when it first aired on, I was in college. And what's interesting about that 60-minute piece, the guy Jim Salit, he starts off that 60-minute piece saying, and I agree with him 100%, if his home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
And I had to agree with him. Now, I've got some things to judge that by. If you live, now this is from my personal observations and experiences. And let me give you paint some pictures with statistics first. In the United States, and I've repeated this several times, but I'll repeat it again for those who are new. About, 3 to 5%, I'm going to put it at 5%. 75 to 80% of the American population in the United States lives on 3 to 5% of the total landmass. That's a whole lot of people crammed into small places. Like New York City, that metro area, what, about 18 million metro? Chicago's got a huge metro area. High density areas. You know, San Francisco, the Inland Empire in California, Bay Area. In Texas, you got three big ones. You've got the Dallas Metroplex, which includes Fort Worth, Texas, Houston, Texas. Then you got San Antonio. But Texas has got like over 200 counties, so there's a lot of places in Texas where the density is like super low. Like I've got 10 acres in far west Texas where, I mean, it's sweet. Granted, the nearest Walmart is 3 hours away, but I'm all right with that. You know, I don't need a Walmart in my zip code, in that particular zip code. But some people are addicted to consumption and seeing the landscape of living in this landscape that's highly dense. In any event, once again, the podcast is titled Affordable Housing Made Illegal via Exclusionary Zoning. Now, once again, let me give my definition. I've got two definitions of affordable housing. Definition number one, my primary definition of affordable housing. Any type of housing that you can afford to pay for cash, out of pocket. You don't have to borrow any money. You don't have to go to a bank. You don't need to save it for a down payment. You don't have to deal with any type of government programs, and there's a lot of government programs for housing. Including what Evansville, Illinois has, you know, with their new reparations bill. You know, you can get up to a certain amount of money if you meet the qualifications for reparations in Evanston, Illinois. None of that. That's my number one. Just like you go into McDonald's, Burger King, you go into a hardware store, you go into a department store, you see something that you want, and you whip out your cash or your debit card. I didn't say credit card, debit card, and you pay cash. Nobody's asking for your credit score. They're not running a credit check, cash, and carry. Once again, the reason why the tiny house movement has been so popular, because the vast majority of tiny houses, that's how they built their homes, out of pocket. The majority of them have not borrowed money. They have not gone to a bank. They have not gone to a finance company. They have not used any government programs to purchase their tiny house. That's the vast majority, particularly in the circles that I run with offline. It's Everybody's built. Nobody's borrowed not one penny from a financial institution. Government doesn't even come up. Now, that's my primary definition. Okay. And they're building these tiny homes, I would say, from out of pocket on a high end, maybe $25,000. Lamar Alexander, who I played his solar cabin audio on here several times, and I played it yesterday. Yesterday we were on, but we came on at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But the solar cabin video that I played on here several times, Lamar Alexander built the tiny house by himself in 2 weeks for $2,000. That's what his cabin cost. And then he put another $3,000 out of pocket for a solar electric system so he can run his – he's got a desktop computer. He's got 12-volt appliances. He operates like everybody else off-grid. In his case, it's off-grid. But he's got power to run fans, desktop, cell phone, $5,000 total out of his pocket. Now, he lives in a rural area in Utah. But if you've listened to the audio before, you've heard him mention that, how you can pick up cheap plots of land by the acre and, where he's done it. So it's affordable. And Lamar was, as he stated in his audio, that he's been homeless twice. But when he learned how to build, he built what he can afford, and he's debt-free, mortgage-free. All right. Definition number two is on affordability. What is an affordable house? I'm going to put it at $50,000, and most people walking around, don't have $50,000. But I'm going to put it at $50,000. Most people who purchase a house that's valued at $50,000 typically have to borrow the money from a bank, maybe some government program or what have you. Depending on the metro area, there's no such thing as a $50,000 affordable house or condo. All right. Now, going back to the title, affordable housing made illegal via exclusionary zoning. One of the things that I avoid when I buy land, and I look at some red flags, if a city and or county has a code enforcement department, I don't deal with it. To me, that's a red flag. There are plenty of counties all over the United States where basically you can virtually do what you want to do and not even pull a building permit. Now, this isn't for beginners, but look on your own, because I don't want you to end up where I'm at, but this is a big country. Here's what I suggest. Look for counties that have a small population. By small population, let's put the small population at, the county has probably no more than 50,000 people living in the county. Actually, no more than 50,000. I want to say 25,000, but I'm going to put it at 50,000 people. Look for small, for instance, a place like Fairfax County, Virginia, which has probably a million plus people, or they're knocking at the door of a million. Too large. They're going to have zoning there because once again, the larger the population, the more government, the rules and regulations, okay? So don't look in a place like Fairfax, Virginia, all right? Avoid places like Cook County, Illinois. I would even say avoid places like Los Angeles County, California. Now, Los Angeles County is pretty big, but for some reason over the last few years, out there they have armed code enforcement officers. Because there's some rural areas out there, but they've been cracking down out in that neck of the woods. I don't know what's in the works there, but maybe we'll cover that one day. As a matter of fact, one day, not maybe, we will cover it. And to go on and hopefully get somebody in from that county who code enforcement has basically regulated them out of their homes. And that's where exclusionary zoning comes in at. The film, the documentary Flag Wars, which we've it's time to bring one of those people that were in that film back on, and we've had them on here twice, takes place. I highly recommend it. You can probably get it, not probably get it on Amazon, but Flag Wars focused in on how zoning, exclusionary zoning, was basically used to, well, I don't know, there's a couple of ways you can look at this. From one camp, and Dr. Frances West Quelzin put me onto that when she was alive. From one camp, you can look at exclusionary zoning was used through the environmental court. And in Columbus, Ohio, because this is where the Flag Wars took place, with exclusionary, with environmental court is building code court. From one camp, you can look at some people used the environmental court to gentrify a neighborhood. That's one camp you can look at it that looks at it that way. And the people that were being pushed out of that particular neighborhood were black folk. Now, from another point of view, you can look at, okay, these are some concerned citizens that want uniformity in their neighborhood. And they're using the environmental court, building code court, to enforce that. That, and it has nothing to do with race. You can look at it that way. Then a third way to look at it is, okay, we don't want our citizens, no matter where they are in Columbus, Ohio, whatever city that we're talking about, and, you know, we don't want the roof to fall in, and, you know, we want the properties to be safe. All three sides, and there might be more, but all three sides have interesting and valid points, or what have you. And Columbus, I believe, is Ohio's largest city. You heard talk on Southern Media's Audio's R1, you know, it. I also recommend not only look for areas that have a small population, I would even say teeny tiny population. I would also suggest look for areas like everything that I buy, because me personally, I like raw land. I don't want no monopolized. I don't want any electricity or natural gas from a monopolized utility company. I'll put in my own system. Thanks to Amazon, anybody can do that now. So I don't, like in D.C., I don't need Pepco. All right, in D.C., they force Pepco down your throat. But in Baltimore, BG, I don't want any of that. I want to be in a place that has none of that. I don't want municipal water. And when it comes to zoning, I like to only purchase land raw land that's zoned agricultural. For me, provides the most freedom for me. Now, I'm extreme. Most people psychologically like the comfort and conveniences of the grid or urban living. Example, if you're in, let's pick Baltimore. Okay, Baltimore, there's a bus line there. Runs all 7 days a week, you know, certain routes run around the clock, 24/7. Some people find comfort in that. A lot of people find convenience at that. The bus company there finds a profit in that. And that, if you want that, fine. They have a, I think, a limited subway system up in Baltimore. Okay. Basically, anything you need is within the city, or you can go to Baltimore County or Anne Arundel County. I mean, you can lead a very comfortable life in Baltimore because many things in a city that size are not only comfortable, but they're convenient. You don't have to travel far to go grocery shopping, to get a tank of gas, to go to the movies, roller skating, bowling, go to church, what have you, go to work. All right. Now, and the counties that are attached to that, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, out in the Bay Area in San Francisco, same thing. Okay, you want to go to Walmart, you want to go to Fisherman's Wharf, you want to get a pair of shoes from whatever shoe store. All the comfort and conveniences, they're there. All right. Me, on the other hand, and the other people like me, that's on 3-5% of the landmass. Me, on the other hand, I'd rather, and that's why I've been picking up land, give me the 95-97% of the country that's rural, where in one case, all right, the nearest Walmart is 3 hours away. But there's a little shop in town, few shops in town, population 1,700 people, where basically I can get all the bases I want right within a town that's got a population of 1,700 people. In Oklahoma, a lot of the black townships there, they might have a lot of them have populations of under 300 people, under 200, some at less than 100 people. However, if you drive 15 minutes in this direction or 20 to 30 minutes in another direction, you can get to the Walmart, the movie theaters, the restaurants, all that other stuff. So depending on where you are in this country, it might be a 15 to 30 minute drive. But I would say start with, and now before I give you the reason why, or let me give you the reason why. In a place like, I'll give you a good example, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Okay. Tulsa, Oklahoma really it's a large city. It's not a New York City. It's not a Dallas, Houston, Miami. And there's nothing like that. But it's got a, matter of fact, let me look it up while I'm talking to you guys. Tulsa and Oklahoma City. Let's see, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa, let's look at the population for Tulsa. Okay, wait a minute. Elevation I want. Tulsa is, what's the population at? All right, here we go. Tulsa's got a population of 391,906 people. Metro area, 401,190. Okay. So let's say that's a large city. Okay. When I go out to Oklahoma, some of you know the destinations I go to already. One destination I went to, which is a historic black township, Summit is one of them. I've been there twice. Tallahassee, Oklahoma. Let me see, what's the population of Tallahassee? Okay. Tallahassee, Oklahoma. Okay. Tallahassee, Oklahoma is 385 acres. The land mass of it. And let's get the population, if I can find the population on here. The population of Tallahassee is anywhere from 106 people to 110 people on 386 acres of land. For me, that's what I call perfect. Utopia almost. Because in a place like that, number one, you got easy access, political access. You know the mayor personally. Y'all might even be neighbors. It's easier for you to get involved politically. And you can basically live like you want to live. Now, 45 minutes away from Tallahassee, and like I said, I've been to Tallahassee before. 45 minutes away from Tallahassee, Oklahoma, you got Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, part of their exclusionary zoning, if you want to plant a vegetable garden in your front yard, let's say you got a front yard and a backyard, in the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma proper, it's outlawed that you can plant vegetables in your front yard. You can get fined. If you go to court, you can find contempt of court. You can go to jail. You can grow them in your backyard, but you can't grow them in your front yard. That's in Tulsa. But for me, all right, I'll drive 45 minutes to Tallahassee or some other rural town that's got a population, like Tallahassee, once again, population 106 people to 110. I don't need 300,000 people. I don't need to be in that environment. So the property taxes are dramatically lower, 45 minutes away. The zoning headaches are dramatically less, 45 minutes away. So I'm willing to drive. And if I want to come into Tulsa to hang out, to go to church or whatever, hey, that's there. And when you talk about Black Wall Street, 1921, there was a social climate where, you know, according to what I've read, because I wasn't living then, you know, that Tulsa, Oklahoma was KKK territory. But Tallahassee, which is the oldest historical black town in the state of Oklahoma, prior to Oklahoma becoming a state, Tallahassee has never had not one second of racial violence. Not one. 45 minutes away from Tulsa. They haven't had to deal with urban renewal, which is commonly called Negro removal. None of that. And Tallahassee is where I would call, and once again, it's a black township. Tallahassee, in my opinion, is what I call, is located within the real United States of America. You can basically go there and paint your canvas the way you wish. You can build a house and be left alone. You can have a rental property there and be left alone. Kids, safe. But most people, and I understand that, once again, 75 to 80% of the population, although I don't know what the shift is, because there's a shift going on right now, you do have a number of people that are telecommuting to work now. I was talking to a friend last night. She used to have to go to work, and she still is. She just started back in the office 5 days a week. But during for the bulk of the pandemic, she was just telecommuting. So they had an office meeting yesterday, and they're talking about, well, maybe just coming to the office twice a week, and then, you know, 3 days you're telecommuting from home. And that's where the ball is moving. Even, you know, even without this pandemic, that's where the ball was going anyway. That's where the ball is going anyway. I mean, and there's almost an infinite amount of Zoom calls that happen around the clock 7 days a week. But, you know, once again, not every lifestyle or every geographical location is for everybody. Because when you're in a rural location, particularly the way I talk about it, being extreme, you're going to have to learn some skills that you might not have picked up in mainstream schooling. You know, things like carpentry, maybe electrical, gardening, farming, and those are two different distinctions, farming and gardening. And we'll cover those as time goes by. But in any event, exclusionary zoning, and maybe that title in itself could be very controversial. Is it racist? Well, to some, it might be. To others, it's not. But this is just my opinion based on my observations and a little experience. Washington, D.C., which used to be called Chocolate City, when I was in high school and college, it was 70%, maybe 71%, the demographics were black. Now you go to Washington, D.C., I think it's 40, that it dropped from 71% down to 46% black. Now, what's the distinction that I've noticed between that time that I was in high school and college and now is, number one, D.C. has a housing court. Housing court is just another moniker for building codes. And, nuisance violations. And once again, depending on who you talk to, you need to have your grass cut. All right, that's a reasonable argument. No neighbor next door, so-and-so should have their tree cut down. Reasonable, argument. Well, all I know is the primary distinction in 2021, and back when I was coming up in high school and college in Washington, D.C., the primary distinction has helped reduce demographically the black population is housing court and rent court. Those are the two primary factors that have changed the complexion of Washington, D.C. Is it racist? Depends on who you talk to. No. If you watch the documentary Flag Wars, and I had to watch that film, I've watched it about 5 or 6 times by now. The first time I watched it, I thought, because somebody died in that movie, that documentary. The first time I watched it, I thought, man, they did a number on black folks. And they used housing court, or what they call environmental court, to do it. That's the first time I watched it. Then I watched it again. Now, I enrolled in law school somewhere along the line during the same time period. Then I watched it again, and my thinking was, you know what? This really has nothing to do with race. It's just black folks on a critical mass basis don't know the rules and regulations that exist in their community. So my thinking changed from A to B the second time I watched it. The third time I watched Flag Wars, I had something else that popped into my head. Once again, I thought it had nothing to do with race. No racism. It wasn't systematic racism or nothing like that, which I thought the very first time I watched it. But the third time I watched it, black folks on a critical mass basis know little or nothing about estate planning. Now, let me give you a backstory. There's a person in the film. I'm about to go to these phone lines here because I know I'm on a rant. It was a person in the film, Linda Mitchell, I believe her name is, and she's featured prominently in this documentary, Flag Wars. Highly recommended. Linda, African American. She lived in a mini mansion in a historic black neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio. And she was cited by code enforcement in Columbus, Ohio. And it was a huge house. Huge, like mini mansion. She was cited for, she had 2 cars, I think. I'm going to put it this way, at least 1 car that needed repair that was in her driveway or whatever on her property. She was cited for that. And then there were several repairs. The property was in disrepair. It was a huge house. It was in disrepair, so she got cited for a lot of that. Linda was the person, the way, by the end of the documentary. She was 39 years old when she passed. All right, but you get to see her character and her speak and her point of view. Because while she was battling code enforcement violations, okay, and she was on a fixed income because she had cirrhosis of the liver. She was ill. So while she was battling, trying to keep her health up, she was battling with code enforcement, including contempt of court, because, you know, you get in contempt, you got to go to jail. All right. She was battling with that. She was trying to keep her health up. She was hospitalized during part of this documentary. They show that in the film. And she was getting unsolicited offers from people who basically all of them were white and gay. This is the film, not L.A. That's why they call it Flag Wars. trying to sell. She had to post something on her house that said, this house is not for sale. I know that because for the last 15 to 20 years, I get postcards and letters, and I live 1,000 miles away from one particular property I have in D.C. right now. I got something yesterday, unsolicited. Man, how many times have I had to tell you the house is not for sale? So she was going through all that. Once again, she passed away before the end of that documentary, and they show her memorial service in the film Flag Wars. So the first time I watched Flag Wars, once again, I'm looking at it from the race card victim mindset. Okay. Once again, the second time I watched it, I had a little law school under my belt at that time. And I found out, oh, wait a minute, this really isn't about race. This is black folk don't know the rules and regulations. They don't know the legal landscape of the home that they live in. Third time I watched it, because her father had worked really hard to buy this house. Like I said, it's a mini mansion. It can be turned into a beautiful bed and breakfast or Airbnb, because Airbnb wasn't even out when this film was made. Okay. It can be a beautiful bed and breakfast if you get it fixed up. But Linda, she was on a fixed income. She just did not have the money to fix up. Now, some of the neighbors pitched in and helped a little bit. And there were five churches within a walking distance of her front door. It's interesting. I guess a memorial service at one of those churches. Black churches in the black community, particularly in urban areas, here's an idea for you. Start a code enforcement outreach or ministry, code enforcement ministry. Because guaranteed, you got some neighbors that are hurting. Use some of that tithe and offering money, and you got the skill set sitting in all these churches. Somebody knows how to put on a roof. Okay, you got to do it by legal means now. You got to pull permits and all that. Organize ministries and outreaches within the black community churches to set this up and make the repairs by the book. The resources are sitting in. Code enforcement officers go to church. And I'm sure some of those people will be glad to work through those ministries. They're church members already anyway. I think that would be a worthy venture of a ministry that's sorely needed in the black community. Anyway, the last time, well, not the last time, but the third time I watched my, you know, I said, Linda Mitchell's father worked real hard to get the house and pay it off. He paid it off. But they didn't do an estate plan. Estate planning, the best illustration I can give for estate planning is, and I got to give some depth to Dr. Boyce Watkins on this, is when you go into a Chinese restaurant in the hood, in a black community, you know, you'll probably see three, maybe four generations of family members in that carryout making your fried rice and egg rolls and egg foo young and all that other stuff. These kids are bought up in the convenience store business, in the gas station business, in a liquor store business. So by the time they're 14, 15, 16 years old, they know how to run a six or seven figure, in many cases, a seven figure business. They don't need to go to Harvard and get an MBA. Which is you got to go through 4 years of your undergrad, then two to three more years to get your MBA. No. They've learned from the time they bought home from the hospital. And Dr. Boyce Watkins says, you know what, we need to start teaching our kids about business. And in this case of Flag Wars or keeping black neighborhoods black, you need to teach your kids estate planning. When you bring them home from the hospital, Because, you know, we all learn by observation. That's how we learn how to walk, talk, run, and all that, by observation. You know, if they see that you think 100 to 150 years out, then they're, by the time they're 12, 13, 14, those ages, they'll be thinking 100 to 150, 200 years out. Linda's parents, as well as the critical mass, and actually across the board, even with white folks, most people don't think generationally. Most people think, I've got mine, I got mine now. You, meaning the kids, you get yours the best way you can. So Linda, once again, this is the third time I watched Flag Wars. Okay. The victimhood card went out the window. And the code enforcement people, because essentially, if you're going to live in a large municipal city, okay, Columbus, Ohio, for all practical purposes, as well as Dallas, Houston, L.A., Chicago, D.C., Orlando, all of these, if it's a municipality, municipalities are businesses. Chicago is a business. Columbus, Ohio is a business. And they have agencies set up within their business to be revenue collectors. So code enforcement is one of their profit centers. Speeding tickets is one of their profit centers. It's their business, and they're not hiding it. It's in plain sight, so all's fair. Now, if you don't want to live in a municipality like that, then move to an area where they don't have those type of profit centers. Simple as that. Anyway, so is it exclusionary zoning? Is it racist zoning? Depends who you talk to. But I would say it's not. Learn the rules and regulations of a place that you're going to be moving to first. I'm just saying, all right, if it's got a zoning department, and if you don't want to deal with zoning at all, that's a code enforcement department, because everybody's got zoning. You know, then you might want to be in West Virginia, because there's a bunch of people that work in Washington, D.C., but they live in West Virginia. You know, it's just less expensive, less zoning headaches. So they work in D.C., and they go home at night. You know, you got people that live in parts of Western Maryland. They drive to D.C., they do what they got to do, go back home at night. At Union Station in Washington, D.C., the train station, there's a mock train that, you know, you don't even need a reservation. Just go buy your ticket, get on. This is Monday through Friday. You know, you got people that don't live in D.C. They'll work there, but they don't want to live there because they don't want to be dealing with any type of particular regulation, because different people have different reasons. Okay. Some people fly in. Some people live in New York City, and they fly into D.C., do what they got to do during the week, fly back home weekend. They got commuter flights that fly from Monday through Friday from Boston to D.C. Just go down, you know, Boston, New York City. A gang of them from Philadelphia. A gang of them from Philly. Some people live in Philly, and they commute three and a half hours from Philadelphia on a daily, Monday through Friday, work in D.C., go back home at night. Others come during the week, go back home the weekend. All right. Me, if I go up there, I used to take the train, but sometimes I'll fly in. I'll fly in for the day. And sometimes I've flown up there for like 15, 20-minute meetings and then fly back the same day. But now, mind you, I don't have to do that every day. I don't have to do that every month. And recently I haven't had to do it in years. So, you know, it's different folks for different folks. But I although it's different, but affordable housing, and the title of this podcast, they affordable housing made illegal via exclusionary zoning. Zoning is the thing, like I say, for the type of houses that I talk about, that I participate in Washington, D.C., as well, I'm speaking right now, in Baltimore, Chicago, and most urban cities in the United States, tiny houses, which are affordable houses, like, let's go with the one that Lamar built. $5,000 total, $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the solar. That type of house is outlawed and banned in a major urban city. There's a whole bunch of people that can afford to live in those type of houses that you out of pocket, without any loans, without any real estate agents. There's a whole bunch of people that can come up with $5,000. They might not be able to come up with it overnight, course of 6 months to 12 months. They can come up with that. Okay, until we get to, you know, this $3,000 for the solar system before you get yourself electrified. All right, I got friends who they go by candlelight. That's how they roll. They don't even like solar. They roll by candlelight. But $2,000, there's a bunch of people that would put things together for like $1,500. But you're not going to have it in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Chicago, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, L.A., San Diego, Oakland, Miami, Orlando, Raleigh, Evanston, Illinois, Chicago, Seattle, Washington. Zoning has banned all that, and that all those types of affordable housing. And I'm not marching and protesting to try to get all these cities to accept it. That's why, you know what? I'll drive 3 hours away to get to freedom. But that's me. So anyway, affordable housing has been made illegal in many parts of the United States through exclusionary zoning. That's my take. Now, let me get off my soapbox because I done ran it the last hour. 410 area code, your mic is open.
Brother L.A., you're with past shows on a cryptocurrency. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it and trying to understand it. I had a whole bunch of questions, but I wanted
well,
to listen
we'll have
first.
Robin and the coach on this week to break that down because I'm still learning myself.
Fantastic. Look, Brother L.A., I know that you're a Bible scholar. And the thing is, you know, we've had these conversations.
I wouldn't
conversations
call myself a scholar
before.
Now.
Well, you know quite a bit. But look, when you read Genesis, the first chapter, after God created man, he showed them all of the animals and everything, told them the name, and he just said, look, I've given you this land.
Right.
And everything, and go out and dominate. He said
right.
that, didn't he? Well, dominate means to control.
Yep. Yeah, right, subdue, yeah.
He said, go out and subdue it and dominate it.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
That means to control it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, Malcolm X had a thing. He says, you know, if I slap you with an open hand, these five digits don't really cause any pain. It just stings a little bit. But if I wrap it, if I wrap these fingers in a fist and hit you with it, that's when you can strike a mighty blow. Well, that's the same thing you're talking about here. Exclusionary zoning is when some people get together and they want to dominate an area, or they want to dominate how things are supposed to go in the sphere where they want to control. And it doesn't matter where you are. You can be in a rural area. You can be in a urban area. But the thing is, if some people put themselves together where they want to dominate a certain area, they can write the laws to do what they want to do. And I agree.
You're absolutely right.
That's where, and I know you get tired of hearing me say it, you have to have an identity, regardless of what it is, whether you're a real estate association or whether you're a community trust association, ever what have you. You have to put yourself in a structure where you can not only dominate but protect what you got. And that's something
I agree.
I know I got this person out there to say, well, who is the we? Well, that's the problem with us black folk. We just got through looking at some houses a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, what you're saying is right. You can build tiny houses, but the one thing you got to have in anything you do is capital. You got to have organization,
right.
And you got to have capital and the proper use of capital. And the trick is this. We don't do it. Now, what you have is a good idea. You don't need a 10 or 12 bedroom house. In fact, you don't need a lot of rooms in a house. I think one time you said the only houses you use is the kitchen, the bathroom, the bedroom, and that's about it.
Yeah,
you
know? Use the kitchen and the bathroom, but you're not living in those. And I probably got, 10 rooms in this house? I only live in one of them.
Exactly. And if you're a family, you only use maybe a great room, you use a kitchen, bathrooms, and bedrooms. And
yeah,
I was just explaining to this young lady, the first thing you do with a house is you hull it in, or either shell it in, and you just do one bedroom at a time. But all I'm telling you is this. What you're talking about, you can't get people to do it because we've been brainwashed into getting a mortgage. We've been brainwashed into getting we've been brainwashed into this rugged individualism. And when it comes to us black folk, and I'm going to say us black folk, see, we done bought in on this thing. Everybody else operates as a wolf pack the way you see it. When they want something, they'll get together with like-minded people, and they'll say, look, I need a house, you need a house, I need some land, you need some land. I ain't got but $1,000, but look, if you find 50 people with $1,000, especially during income tax time, you can say, well, look, this year we'll take the 50 and we'll go and find acreage, and we'll split it up to where everybody got it. And look, we're all working. And the next time income tax time come, we'll go in and do one house or two houses at a time until everybody got it. But I just said that to say this. Social capital is missing in the black neighborhood and the need. But see, when you get together with people that need the same thing you need, you can find a solution. And the thing is, Brother L.A., that's what happens with gentrification. That's what happens when we need something, housing, and that's what happened with zoning. See, if you got the power and you use your power, and that power comes from self-preservation or survival of the fittest, what happens is you can foresee someone coming in and zoning your area. You can foresee somebody coming in and wanting to gentrify your area because you know the close proximity of where that property is and the value of it. And you can go in and do some zoning to protect yourself. But the thing is, all we're used to doing is living. And that's
you know
it.
What? You're
we
absolutely right, Beasley. You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, let's go back to identity. because I'm gonna use DC and Baltimore in this case. Let's start with Baltimore. Baltimore, I don't know. Do you remember the Inner Harbor? What the Inner Harbor was like before it got gentrified?
I heard about it. I got there after it had been done.
Okay, all right. I remember it. It was all black on top of black.
That's what I heard.
But you're absolutely right. In order to prevent neighborhood takeover demographically, you're right. You got to have the identity up there.
That's right.
That's been the mystery. And you're absolutely right. If you haven't identified, you're not even going to take the first step to get organize your social capital.
That's right.
And that's what's happened to D.C., and that's what happened to the Inner Harbor of Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. Now, people, and I'm going to use this year as an example, and look, you can cut me off anytime you want to because I know you're short on time. If Jews had been living in that Inner Harbor section, that black section, they would have seen that, hey, look, you know what? We're close to water here. We can go in and we can get together with our money and go in our synagogues, and we can go in and put our money together and develop this, and we can have a commercial center here to where all of us can live good. But because black folks haven't been conditioned into organizing around their identity and using social capital, what happened is those people came in and moved them out. And that's how gentrification works. First, you got to realize that what you have is valuable. Then
right.
After you do that, you take the proper steps to go ahead and make sure you protect it. And after you do that, you find out how it can be used to your advantage to promote yourself and everybody else that has an interest. And that's what we haven't been able to do because, look, there's nowhere in the world that D.C. is supposed to be gentrified. When I got there,
it
was
is.
About what?
50%? But you know what? You're absolutely right because D.C. had no shortage. First thing, the black folk that work and live in, well, you know that area. The income is there. The money is there.
That's right.
The money is there. The technical know-how is there. The number
right.
of churches is there. Same as Baltimore.
That's right.
But the missing link is no zero social capital. There was no organization around an identity. Because you got a whole bunch of lone wolves fighting a battle, and that's how the city got gentrified.
Well, like you said before, I got mine, and that's that rugged rugged individual.
Well, that's true. That's the attitude up there. I got mine.
Yeah, and see, everybody else, all the other ethnic groups and people, and look, knowledgeable people, because you got that in every ethnic group. But everybody else said, well, hey, we got a good thing here. Let's go ahead on, and as that Bible verse says, you can read it. Maybe I misinterpreted, but God said, look, I've given you all of this earth, and I've given you every fruit-bearing seed and beast of the field. Now go out and subdue it. And see, that's something that we're scared to do. That's been.
You know what, you done hit the nail on the head. I'm gonna have to go. I know what you're talking about. I'm gonna read that as a reminder myself because if you look at, I just heard a podcast or a YouTube video on this probably within the last 48 hours. Piggybacking on what you're saying, or dovetailing on what you're saying. The Asians who have gone into, and other groups, but Asians who have gone into these black neighborhoods and set up liquor stores, dry cleaners, carry out restaurants that even sell, if you want some of the best soul food in D.C. or Baltimore, whatever, you got Koreans selling it. Now,
and black people
are cooking it, but it's the Koreans or the Vietnamese at the cash register. They own the business.
Yeah.
So the what they said was a lot of these, you know what, just like they have these Amway and Mary Kay opportunity meetings here in the United States, I'm sure somewhere in Vietnam or Beijing, China, they're having opportunity meetings about black neighborhoods in this country. Because typically the zoning laws are less relaxed, the prices of property, the cost of doing business is easier to set up in a black neighborhood, low-income black neighborhood, as opposed to a high-end neighborhood. And that's why a lot of these, you know, foreign businesses have come in, and they have, and the word that you use is very accurate, they have come into an area where we didn't dominate.
And we
dominated.
And they
have dominated. Because we didn't set up businesses in our own community.
Exactly. See, you know, and look, nobody could have sold this integration thing to another ethnic group. Nobody, except black folk. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, and I'm going to get off because I know time is short, but all I'm telling you is this. Number one, you got to have the identity. Number two is you got to have practice. You got to be selfish. Self-preservation,
right,
and survival of the fittest. And the other thing is you got to know the value of what you have as a people, as a group, as a community.
Now, you know, what you just said makes a whole bunch. I'll give you an example. There's, and I'm sure this happens with all the liquor stores, but there's a liquor store in my neighborhood in D.C., been there for a gazillion years. Now, every few years, and it's always the people who run that liquor store are basically Asian. Okay, see mama, son, papa, son. You see typically three, sometimes four generations in it. They'll hire a couple of two, three people from the neighborhood, you know, for parents' reasons. But the people that run the show, and everybody knows it, are basically these Asian families. Now, every few years, they switch families. In other words, the liquor license will pass from one family to the next. So you're right. They keep it within their own social circles.
Exactly. And look, I'm going to give you this, Brother Elliot, and I'm going to let you get back to your show because I know somebody else wants to jump in here. When I said those five digits, like Malcolm X said, you ball it up into a fist and you strike a mighty blow. And every town I've been in, they've been in a Korean Grocers Association. And they cover all of the regulations. They cover all of the zoning. They cover everything that it takes for them to do business. And they cover the financing. If you want to come in and you're just off the plane, and you wants to do some business in that town, you go to them, and they will cover every avenue that it takes for you to put up business, including the stocking and everything else. And the thing is, I could not get all of the merchants in Baltimore to do that. I talked to them until I turned almost white, and you know how black I am. And the thing is, see, everybody gets together around their identity, their need, and they get together with, hey, look, we got opportunity here. And they come up with a way to protect it. So with that being said, until it happens, see, and look, here's the other thing. Gentrification in black neighborhoods would never occur if we owned the property in the first place. Most of us are renting.
Right.
And you can't tell me all of those churches in Baltimore and all of those churches in D.C. couldn't get together and say, wait a minute, hold it. 60% of my congregation is renting, and another 40% is getting Section 8. We can take this money, and we can go in and we can control everything that runs around in this city, every dime, because I did the calculations when I was in Baltimore. 75 cents out of every dollar in the town proper was going through black hands, and it was going through somebody else, and we were feeding somebody else's children. So with that being said, yeah, what you're saying is makes sense, but it doesn't make sense to senseless people. So you're
That's
preaching
true.
To the choir. In fact, your voice is like a lone voice in the wilderness. And until we get together and get this thing straightened out, we're going to be extinct by 2050.
Well Claude Anderson has said that. All right, we'll be back in 2 minutes. Point of view, particularly the video where lady, she was a white woman. She said, her video was titled, Do You Live in a Racist City? And she, her whole thing, this is a white woman talking, not me. Her point of view on it was, more than likely you live in a racist city that has exclusionary zoning. So in any event, it's and we'll bring this topic on, but I'm just looking at it from, not even from the race car point of view. I'm looking at it, you know, for, because I like extreme housing. And tiny houses or extreme housing, one form of extreme housing. But also, like, I've seen some extreme houses. People have taken, you know, jet planes after they, you know, and turned that into an extreme house. You know, van conversions or extreme housing. People have taken silos, corn silos or whatever, and turned those into the street. So I absolutely love extreme housing. But that type of housing is not going to fly in downtown Manhattan. I get that. But it will fly in upstate New York, depending on what community that you go into. And most likely, these are rural communities that, you know, you can get away with legally extreme housing. So, you know, there's a time and place, you know, for all that. And in Mongolia, and their capital city, I don't want to butcher the name. But Mongolia, their capital city, I think 40% of the city lives in tents. Historically, Mongolia has been a nomad nation, you know, dating back to even before Genghis Khan. And but 40% of their capital today is set aside for yurts. Yurts are nothing more than tents. They're very stylish. They look very good. And, you know, but the people that live in yurts, they don't have a mortgage. You know, they're you can call them a glorified tent. But culturally, in the capital city of Mongolia, it works. You know, so, you know, you know, if you don't like a particular place, then move to a place that it's more in line with your household living and political things. But, yeah, like I said, I love extreme housing. But I know extreme housing is not going to fly in a New York City, D.C., L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, Washington. I know that, and I'm fine with that. That's why you won't see me marching in none of those cities, because I go to places where extreme housing is welcomed. Okay. Let's take our last caller here, because we are in overtime. 314, your mic is open.
My goodness, L.A., you could have been over an hour ago and gone by your business looking for extreme housing.
I know. Well, I went on.
And you ain't going to march in Mongolia.
No. Well, if I want to live in a yurt in Mongolia, I know where to go, and I don't have to march because it's culturally acceptable in this particular city. Oh, I'm not
well,
trying
you
to
got
march
one
nowhere.
Thing working against you, and it's quite obvious. But in another thing, 50 people ain't going to do nothing on no 1 acre. How you going to build a home on 800 square feet of ground?
Hey, you're the construction man.
You
got
to pay attention to
different,
what people be saying.
Yeah, different. I don't know, like in California, I'm not going to, because we're out of time for that.
Well, let me get
in Los Angeles, to be exact, there was a guy, his video's on YouTube. He was building these tiny houses and basically giving them away. And then code
enforcement
came
that's an odd case. That's not the general rule, though, L.A.
You know, code enforcement came along. All right, I get that. But now in Los Angeles now has, sanctioned by the city of Los Angeles, they have a tiny house community.
A tiny house community, right? That's good.
Yeah.
Have a community, but don't put tiny houses amongst other houses that's protected by codes or one residential classification.
Okay, now you are a code enforcement person. Okay, tell educate us on.
Well, let's look at the numbers.
Hang on for a second. Code enforcement person.
If it protects the safety of people, that's what it does. Now think, if you got a community where in Washington D.C. I think you said Washington D.C. is the second most richest community of blacks in the nation. They don't want no tiny house placed amongst their $500,000 to $800,000 homes. Why? Because it brings down their value. Then you got somebody that's going to build a house for $25,000. His taxes is not going to be appreciable to the amount of services that he is receiving, where other people are basing their taxes on $800,000. He got police protection that he couldn't afford if he had a $25,000 community. He can't afford that type of police protection that you're going to have in Washington, D.C. He couldn't afford the sewage.
Right,
he couldn't afford the water.
Me,
he couldn't afford the electricity.
Let me ask you this then. Okay. Could it be D.C., St. Louis, whatever? Let's stick to D.C. so we start with that. Now, there are parts of D.C. that neighborhoods have been raised decades ago, okay, where there are no $500,000 houses. What about setting, of course, you have to go through the legal channels. What about those areas where
there's no... You hear the key word you said there.
Huh?
Listen, folks, you don't even have to go further. See the key word you said, parts of D.C.
Right.
You know that you got some nice parts of D.C. that's paying taxes, that's being overly spent in the bad portion of D.C. where the crime is sky high. Think about it.
Well, that's true, because a lot of the taxes that people, let's see,
How about Spring Valley,
which is in northwest D.C. Spring Valley, very affluent area in the western part of
D.C.
And
I bet they all send their kids to private school. They're not going to send their kids to no D.C. public school.
Most of them do. However, a lot of their tax money, you're right, a lot of their tax money, which goes to the police department, is basically used, those resources are used more so in parts of southeast and parts of northeast D.C.
And what's the demographics there?
What's the phenotype?
What's the phenotype there in demographics? Hey, black.
Right.
Am I right?
You're right.
All right. That settles that question. This white woman talking about Jim Crow, and is your city race? Well, what about cities that's got an all-black government? Then that dispels the notion that blacks can't be racist. She don't know what she's talking about. Exclusion zone. I told you I like exclusion zone.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. In zoning,
what's that expression? Not in my backyard. And that's fair enough.
Absolutely. That goes with prisons, too. That's why come they build prisons in the rural area and blacks claim they ain't got no jobs. Well, it's your black politicians that use the term not in my backyard. Another point. Let's see. That one man that said that he had this house that he showed his girlfriend who became his wife, and now he's being wanted to use eminent domain. And, well, we can say that white man is being discriminated against. I thought whites don't be discriminated against. And another point, if you got farmland out in the rural area and people start moving out there with tiny homes, but what happens when a Walmart builds a store, a super shopping center next to your farmland? Guess what happens? The taxes on your farmland goes up. It has to. It's got to.
That's true. I know somebody, he moved from a location
And the funny thing about that guy,
he thought he was isolated enough until the Walmart came in, then he moved.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that guy talking about he wasn't going to move. In other words, the city is making him do something, but he's in the pharmaceutical industry. And today, the pharmaceutical industry is part of making the citizenry do something that a lot of them don't want to do, and that's be vaccinated.
That's true. A lot of people do not want to be vaccinated.
And finally, I know a whole lot about cryptocurrency, but some people I ain't teaching a damn thing. And I explained that to you when I invited you to a call. Don't tell them fools. Let them go.
No, I didn't invite nobody to the call. I came on by myself. I was there for this last call I was on. It was 2 weeks ago. I was there for the. I came in 2 minutes late, but heard everything. I got to pick up a new vocabulary for that group.
I was on 10 minutes, man. I was less on 9 minutes. See how much I got out of 9 minutes? I had to go into no story talking about no license plates or no model. What model are you, or identity, and so forth. I'm going to go back to pondering whether or not I position myself to get these 1,000 shares of Tesla that's selling for $8.575 a share. I don't know if I do or not.
Well, all right. Well, we're going to wrap it up for today, Pianki. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for everybody, Beasley, everybody. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.